Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. What we have been doing for some months now is exploring the myths about money. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. We've been specifically looking at a book called The Web of Debt, which unravels the deception and presents a clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It then explores workable alternatives. The author is Ellen Brown, and it is a book that everyone should read. In the solution area, we have tapped into a number of sources and resources, in particular the Thrive Movement website, thrivemovement.com. We specifically investigated into the top 10 actions, what you can do in terms of solutions. Those, as a brief review, are 1. Get informed, speak up, and connect with others. 2. Bank locally. 3. Buy and invest responsibly. 4. Join the movement to audit and end the Federal Reserve. 5. Keep the internet fair and open. 6. Support independent media. 7. Support organic non-GMO farming. 8. Require election and campaign finance reform. 9. Advocate for renewable and free energy. And 10. Take part in critical mass action. Then in the last show, we were very specific and we looked at Forrest Gamble's Time for an Economic Bill of Rights. I ended up with How the System Evolved, an analysis on that aspect. The current system of privately issued money is traced in modern money mechanics to the 17th century goldsmiths. People who left gold with the goldsmiths for safekeeping would be issued paper receipts called banknotes. Other people who wanted to borrow money were also happy to accept paper banknotes in place of gold, since the notes were safer and more convenient to carry around. The sleight of hand came in when the goldsmiths discovered that people would come for their gold only about 10% of the time. That meant that up to 10 times as many notes could be printed and lent as the goldsmiths had gold. 90% of the notes were basically counterfeited. This system was called fractional reserve banking and was institutionalized when the Bank of England was founded in 1694. The bank was allowed to lend its own banknotes to the government, forming the national money supply. Only the interest on the loans had to be paid. Debt was rolled over indefinitely. All of this is still true today. The U.S. federal debt is never paid off, but just continues to grow, forming the basis of the U.S. money supply, with the basic bank being the Federal Reserve, which, of course, is a private banking institution. But there are other ways to create a banking system, ways that would eliminate its Ponzi scheme elements and make the system sustainable. One solution is to make the loans interest-free, but for Western economies today, that transition could be most difficult. Another alternative is for banks to be publicly owned. If the people collectively own the bank, the interest and profits go back to the government and the people, who benefit from decreased taxes, increased public services, and cheaper public infrastructure. Cutting out interest has been shown to reduce the cost of public projects by 30 to 50%, for example. In fact, in the United States, this system of publicly owned banks goes back to the American colonists. The best of the colonial models was in Benjamin Franklin's colony of Pennsylvania, where the government operated a land bank. Money was printed and lent into the community. It recycled back to the government and could be lent and relent. The system was mathematically sound because the interest and profits were returned to the government, which then spent the money back into the economy in place of taxes. Private banks, by contrast, generally lend their profits back into the economy or invest in private money-making ventures, in which more is always expected back than was originally invested. During the period that the Pennsylvania system was in place, the colonists paid no taxes except excise taxes, prices did not inflate, and there was no government debt. And then we discussed how private banknotes became the national U.S. currency. The Pennsylvania system was sustainable, but some early American colonial governments just printed and spent, inflating the money supply and devaluing the currency. The British merchants complained, prompting King George II to forbid the colonists to issue their own money. Taxes had to be paid to England in gold. That meant going into debt to the English bankers. The result was a massive depression. The colonists finally rebelled and went back to issuing their own money, precipitating the American Revolution. In an international first, the colonists funded a war against a major power with mere paper receipts and won. But the British counterattacked by waging a currency war. They massively counterfeited the colonists' paper money at a time when this was easy to do. By the end of the war, the paper script was virtually worthless. After it lost its value, the colonists were so disillusioned with paper money that they left the power to issue it out of the U.S. Constitution. Meanwhile, Alexander Hamilton, the first U.S. Treasury Secretary, was faced with huge war debts, and he had no money to pay for them. He therefore resorted to the ruse used in England known as fractional reserve banking. In 1791, Hamilton set up the first U.S. bank, a largely private bank that would print banknotes backed by gold and lend them to the government. The ruse worked, the paper banknotes expanded the money supply, the debts were paid, and the economy thrived. But it was the beginning of a system of government funded by debt to private bankers, who lent banknotes only nominally backed by gold. During the American Civil War, President Lincoln avoided a crippling war debt by returning to the system of government-issued money of the American colonists. He issued U.S. notes from the Treasury called greenbacks, rather than borrowing at usurious interest rates. But Lincoln was assassinated, and greenback issuance was halted. In 1913, the privately owned Federal Reserve was authorized to issue its own Federal Reserve notes as the national currency. These notes were then lent to the government, eliminating the government's own power to issue money, except for coins. The Federal Reserve was set up to prevent bank runs, but 20 years later, we had the Great Depression, the greatest bank run in history. Robert H. Hemphill, credit manager of the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta, wrote in 1934, quote, "We are completely dependent on the commercial banks. Someone has to borrow every dollar we have in circulation, cash or credit. If the banks create ample synthetic money, we are prosperous. If not, we starve." For the bankers, however, it has been a good system. It put them in control. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. But this was just the beginning of the global debt trap. Professor Carol Quigley was an insider groomed by the international bankers. He wrote in Tragedy and Hope in 1966, quote, "The powers of financial capitalism had another far-reaching aim, nothing less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. The apex of the system was to be the Bank for International Settlements, the BIS, in Basel, Switzerland, a private bank owned and controlled by the world's central banks, which were themselves private corporations. Each central bank sought to dominate its government by its ability to control treasury loans." End quote. The debt trap was set in stages. In 1971, the dollar went off the gold standard internationally. Currencies were unpegged from gold and allowed to float in currency markets, competing with other currencies, making them vulnerable to speculation and manipulation. In 1973, a secret agreement was entered into in which the OPEC countries would sell oil only in dollars, and the price of oil would be dramatically increased. By 1974, oil prices had increased by 400% from the 1971 levels. Countries lacking oil had to borrow dollars from U.S. banks. In 1981, the Fed funds rate was raised to 20%. At 20% compound interest, debt doubles in under 4 years. As a result, most of the world became crippled by debt. By 2001, developing nations had repaid the principal originally owed on the debts 6 times over, but their total debt had quadrupled because of interest payments. When debtor nations could not pay the banks, the International Monetary Fund stepped in with loans with strings attached. The debtors had to agree to austere measures, including cutting social services, privatizing banks and public utilities, opening markets to foreign investors, letting currencies float. Today, austerity measures are being imposed not just in developing countries, but in the European Union and on U.S. states. What Professor Quigley foretold about the Bank for International Settlements has also come to pass. The BIS now has 55 member nations and heads the global financial pyramid. The power of the BIS was seen in 1988 when it raised the capital requirements of its member banks from 6% to 8% in an accord called Basel I. The result was to cripple the Japanese banks, which until then were the world's largest creditors. Japan entered a recession from which it has not yet recovered. U.S. banks managed to escape by dodging the capital requirement. They did this by moving loans off their books, bundling them up as securities, and selling them to investors. To persuade the investors to buy them, these mortgage-backed securities were protected against default with derivatives, which were basically just bets. The protection seller collected a premium for agreeing to pay in the event of default. The protection buyer bought the premium. Owning the asset was not required. Like gamblers at a horse race, derivative players could bet without owning a horse. Derivatives became a very popular form of gambling. The result was the mother of all bubbles, exceeding $500 trillion by the end of 2007. Because of securitization and derivatives, credit mushroomed. Then virtually anyone who walked in the door could get a loan. The real tipping point came in August of 2007 with the collapse of two hedge funds. When the derivatives scheme was exposed, the market for derivative-protected securities suddenly dried up. But the U.S. stock market did not collapse until November of 2007, when new accounting rules were imposed. The rules grew out of Basel II. Accords initiated by the BIS in 2004. Mark-to-market accounting required banks to value their assets according to market demand that day. Many U.S. banks, like those in Japan in the 1990s, suddenly had insufficient capital to make new loans. The result was a credit crisis from which the U.S. has not yet recovered. The result is that the BIS has now become global regulator, just as Quigley foresaw. In April of 2009, the G20 nations agreed to be regulated by a financial stability board based in the BIS and to comply with standards and codes set by the board. The codes are only guidelines, but countries that fail to comply risk downgrades in their credit ratings, something so costly that the guidelines have effectively become laws. An article on the BIS website states that the central banks in the Central Bank Governance Network should have as their single or primary objective to preserve price stability. That means governments should not devalue the national currency by inflating the money supply. And that means not printing money or borrowing credit created by their own central banks. Like the American colonies after King George took away their power to issue their own money, governments must fund their deficits by borrowing from private banks. The bankers' global control over currency issuance has become virtually complete. The effects of this policy are particularly evident in the European Union, where EU rules allow deficits of only 3% of government budgets and prevent member countries from either issuing their own money or borrowing credit advanced by their own central banks. Member nations must borrow instead from the European Central Bank, private international banks, or the IMF. The result has been forced austerity measures, as seen in Greece and Ireland. The system is so unsustainable that commentators are predicting that the EU may break up. So, as one solution, we must return the money power to public control. To escape the debt trap of the global bankers, the power to create the national money supply needs to be restored to national governments. Some alternatives include legal tender issued directly by national treasuries and spent on national budgets. Second thing is publicly owned central banks empowered to advance the nation's credit and lend it to the government interest free. A third alternative is nationalization of bankrupt banks considered too big to fail after expunging or writing down bad debts on inflated bubble assets. These banks could then issue credit to the public and serve the public's banking needs, with the profits recycling back to the government, defraying the tax burden on the people. Another possible alternative is publicly owned local banks, state, provincial, or municipal. Publicly owned banks have been successfully established and operated in many countries, including Australia, New Zealand, Canada, Germany, Switzerland, India, China, Japan, Korea, and Malaysia. And I'll return to this point in a moment. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Looking at the United States, there is currently only one state-owned bank, the Bank of North Dakota. The model, however, has proven to be highly successful. North Dakota is the only U.S. state to have escaped the credit crisis unscathed. In 2009, while other states floundered, North Dakota had its largest budget supply ever. In 2008, the Bank of North Dakota, the BND, had a return on equity of 25%. North Dakota has the lowest unemployment rate in the country and the lowest default rate on loans. It also has the most local banks per capita. North Dakota has had its own banks since 1919, when farmers were losing their farms to the Wall Street bankers. They organized, won an election, and passed legislation. The state is required by law to deposit all its revenues in the BND. Like with the sustainable model of the Bank of Colonial Pennsylvania, interest and profits are returned to the government and to the local economy. A growing movement is afoot in the United States to copy this public banking model in other states. 14 U.S. state legislatures have now initiated bills for state-owned banks. The model could also be replicated in other countries. In Ireland, for example, where the major banks are insolvent and are already nationalized or soon will be, the government could deposit its revenues in its own publicly owned banks, add sufficient capital to meet capital requirements, and leverage these funds to create interest-free credit for its own local needs. This is exactly what Alexander Hamilton did when faced with government debts that were impossible to repay. He put the government's existing funds in a bank, then borrowed the money back several times over, employing the accepted fractional reserve model. Japan's solution is also a variant of what Alexander Hamilton proposed two centuries earlier. Japan retains its status as the third largest economy in the world, although it has a debt to GDP ratio of 226%. Japan has monetized the national debt, turning it into the national money supply. The government-owned Bank of Japan holds Japanese government debt equal to 100% of the nation's GDP. And because the government owns the bank, this loan is interest-free and can be rolled over indefinitely. An interest-free loan rolled over indefinitely is the equivalent of issuing money. Now let's look a little closer at this in the United States. From an article by Ellen Brown, Feds to States Drop Dead. State bank movement picks up steam. A famous headline in 1975 said, Ford to New York, drop dead. President Ford had declared flatly that he would veto any bill calling for a federal bailout of New York City. What he proposed instead was legislation that would make it easier for the city to go bankrupt. Now, the Federal Reserve and Federal Treasury system seem to be saying this to the states, which are slated to be the first ritual victims in the battle over the budget ceiling. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner said that the Treasury would stop issuing special securities that help state and local governments pay for their debt. This was to be the first in a series of extraordinary measures taken by the Treasury to avoid default in the event that Congress failed to raise the debt ceiling. The Secretary said that these extraordinary measures have been set in motion. The Federal Reserve, too, has declared that it cannot help the states with their budget problems, although those problems were created by the profligate banks under the Fed's purview. The Fed advanced $12.3 trillion in liquidity and short-term loans to bail out the financial sector from the 2008 banking collapse, 64 times the $191 billion required to balance the budgets of all 50 states. But Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke declared that the Fed could not make the same cheap credit lines available to state and local governments, not because the Fed couldn't find the money, but because it was not in the Fed's legislative mandate. Now, the federal government can fix its own budget problems by raising its debt ceiling, and the too-big-to-fail banks have the federal government and Federal Reserve to fall back on. But these options are not available to state governments. Like New York City in 1975, many states are teetering on bankruptcy. But there is a beacon in the storm. Many states are in trouble, but not all. North Dakota has consistently boasted large surpluses, aided by a state-owned bank that is showing landmark profits. the Bank of North Dakota reported profits for 2010 of $62 million, setting a record for the seventh straight year. The BND's profits belong to the citizens and are produced without taxation. The Center for State Innovation, based in Madison, Wisconsin, was commissioned to do detailed analysis for Washington and Oregon. Their conclusion was that a state-owned bank on the model of the Bank of North Dakota would have a substantial positive impact on employment, new lending, and government revenue in those states. The BND partners with local banks in providing much-needed credit for local businesses and homeowners. It also helps with local government funding needs. When North Dakota went over budget a few years ago, according to the bank's president, Eric Hardmeyer, the BND acted as a rainy day fund for the state. And when a North Dakota town suffered a massive flood, the BND provided emergency credit lines to the city. Having a cheap and readily available credit line with the state's own bank reduces the need for massive rainy day funds that are a waste of capital and are largely invested in out-of-state banks at very modest interest. So what can states do with their own banks? North Dakota has a population that is less than one-tenth the size of Los Angeles. The BND produces $62 million in revenue and $2.2 billion in loans. Larger states could generate much more. Banks create bank credit from capital and deposits. The Bank of North Dakota has $2.7 billion in deposits, or $4,000 per capita. The majority of these deposits are drawn from the state's own revenues. The bank has nearly the same sum, $2.6 billion, in outstanding loans. You can get a rough idea of what a state bank could do for your state, then, by multiplying the population by $4,000. California, for example, has 37 million people. If it had a state-owned bank that performed like the BND, it might amass $148 billion in deposits. This $148 billion could then generate $142 billion in credit for the state, assuming the bank could come up with $12 billion in capital to satisfy the 8% capital requirement imposed on banks. Note that this capital would not be an expenditure. It would just be an investment, and like any capital investment, it would actually make money for the state. The Bank of North Dakota has had a return of equity in recent years of 25 to 26%, and a major portion of this has been returned to the state treasury. All states have massive rainy day funds of various sorts. Some of this money could simply be shifted into equity in the state's own bank. There are many options for using the state's credit power, but here is one easy alternative that illustrates the cost-effectiveness of the approach. Assume California's state-owned bank invested $142 billion in municipal bonds at 5% interest. This would give the state $7 billion annually in interest income. California has outstanding general obligation bonds and revenue bonds of $158 billion, and $70 billion goes for interest. If California had been funding its debt through its own bank for the last decade or two, it would have saved $70 billion on its bonded debt and would be that much richer today. In a futile attempt to balance the budget in a shrinking economy, we have been pressured into a self-destructive economic model in which the only alternatives are said to be to slash services, raise taxes, and sell off public assets. These are not our only alternatives. What destroyed our local economies was not excess government spending, but was a credit crisis on Wall Street. We can restore the prosperity we lost by restoring credit in the state, and we can do that by taking our deposits out of Wall Street banks and putting them in our own state-owned banks to be leveraged into credit for local purposes. And we'll continue next week. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.